This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to the podcast for Woman's Hour for Friday the 7th of June. Elizabeth McGovern, best known as Lady Cora in Downton Abbey, soon to be in the cinema, has a new film, The Chaperone, and the role of the wife in middle age in the West End play The Starry Messenger. She's now 57. How much are things improving for women in the acting profession as they get older? In Coaching Week, the tennis coach Francesca Lewis trains some of the best junior players in the world, and the serial, the final episode of I Am a Slave. Now, it's been quite a week as we followed the arrival of Donald Trump, his wife Melania and his entire family for a state visit in the presence of the Queen and almost her entire family. The Duchess of Sussex, of course, was absent from the official programme. Then there was the commemoration of D-Day on both sides of the Channel, the Peterborough by-election in which Labour won a narrow victory. And today is the day on which Theresa May officially steps down as leader of the Conservative Party, although she remains Prime Minister until a new one is chosen. Well, with me to unpick the week's news are Bonnie Greer, a columnist with the New European newspaper, playwright and critic, Sarah Elliott, who chairs Republicans Overseas UK, and Jess Brammer, the executive editor of HuffPost UK. Jess, the results of Peterborough are in. Labour won by a majority of 683. Brexit Party came second. How surprised were you at that result?
I was genuinely quite surprised, actually. I think fascinating result. A lot of relief amongst Remainers in the UK today. I would say misplaced relief. That 683 votes was very, very close. And I think the Brexit Party have shown that they are a genuinely disruptive force in UK politics at the moment. Having said that, they did fail in their first electoral test to get an MP into Westminster. That's clearly significant. Internally in Labour, lots of soul searching because she was a problematic candidate. She had liked a Facebook post that mentioned Theresa May being subject to Zionist slave master's agenda. So there's a lot of people in Labour who are welcoming the result, but obviously saying that there's a lot of soul searching within the party to do this morning.
Sarah, what have you read into such a narrow majority and Brexit coming second?
That basically the Conservatives have to follow through with Brexit or you're going to have a Labour government. I think the Brexit Party is taking votes away from the Conservatives, and this is a very dangerous path for the party. And as it has been for the last several years, it's been Parliament versus the people, and Conservative MPs better start listening to their constituencies and get to work.
Bonnie?
I think we need to be clear that the Brexit Party is a pressure group that calls itself the Brexit Party. And what the people of Peterborough did was get serious and decide that they wanted a political party to run their area. One of the things I said this morning on Twitter is that I think, and I mentioned the BBC, but I don't want to make it entirely the BBC's issue. But Nigel Farage has been promoted pretty much in this country as some sort of force. What it does is it helps people to gather with him, basically as Jess rightly said, a disruptive force. But we're now in a moment when social media and traditional news are in collision. And the corporation, which I'm second to none in my admiration for it and in its prowess, has got to step back a bit now and look at its role in promoting this man. We're in a very dangerous place
right
now.
But you see, you call it a pressure group. They are actually officially now a political party, albeit a new one.
They're a political party because they registered as one. I'm talking about a pressure group and the fact that, and I'm saying this with respect, but a political party, as you know, is an ecosystem. It's a very complex mechanism. It not only has an issue that it promotes, it has other things it does. I'm talking about this not as a partisan for Labor, although I vote Labor, but for the conservatives, the Lib Dems, the Greens. These are political parties. This is a pressure group, and we're at a moment in time where this pressure group is sucking the oxygen out of our political process and making it very dangerous.
Well, it was a pressure group before David Cameron decided to have the referendum. And it forced UKIP, in this case, forced David Cameron to have one to settle the issue in the Conservative Party over Europe. Now it is definitely a full-fledged political party because, let's face it, the Conservatives haven't done a good job under Theresa May. And getting a withdrawal agreement through. They are legitimate. They have elected politicians now. It's all about how the mainstream parties are going to respond to this.
Yes.
I think the interesting thing about Bonnie's point is that, yes, they are a pressure group, and we will be waiting to see when a general election comes what their policies are in other areas. Mm-hmm. But they have had a huge impact on the policies of the mainstream political parties. And that, if you don't support them, is alarming, because they may well be a pressure group, but their policies have impacted
but,
on the people.
But just that doesn't make them not a pressure group. You know, and the reason I'm saying that is we are at a point where we have to decide as a political entity, and I'm talking about the United States as well, whether we are actually going to be involved in politics or we're going to be involved in pressure groups getting the kind of sort of huge publicity that this one is getting. Nigel Farage was more quoted on the news today than almost everyone else. The Labour Party held the seat. Now, that should have been the news, because actually the betting was the Labour Party was not going to win. Labour Party held the seat. Okay, they lost a lot of votes, but they held. The Lib Dems did very well. The Conservatives got hurt. That's the news, not this.
But is there not value in putting to Nigel Farage that they failed to win a seat if you're not a supporter of theirs?
It's not about value. It's about us understanding that we are in a very febrile time, and we have to decide, and I'm not saying I'm not a journalist, but I think journalism has to decide what landscape it's helping to create. This man and his party are disruptive forces are fun, and Nigel Farage is clickbait. But we're at a moment now in this country that is the most febrile since the Civil War.
If you don't take Nigel Farage seriously,
I didn't say that.
He's just clickbait.
I didn't say that.
That really riles up his base. That actually really gets people to go out even stronger for him.
I didn't say that I didn't take him seriously. I wouldn't be talking about it if I didn't take him seriously. He's very serious.
Let's move on to the other big event of the week, the Trump visit. Sarah, how much of a success was it?
I think it was a great success. I think it was a great success for both of our countries. I want to thank the British government and the royal family for their lovely hospitality to the President of the United States of America. I thought that Donald Trump was humbled in the presence of the Queen. I think the grandeur of the occasion, but also the way he was treated with respect, made him feel welcomed.
Not entirely treated with respect.
Well,
but
by everyone he met. I mean, I think Sadiq Khan purposefully put that piece on the Sunday Observer just to instigate that little rivalry they have, and he responded in kind, as Trump will do. He doesn't back down, but I think overall it went exceptionally well. You saw a statesman in Trump. You saw a more humbled man, and what I like to see is he was very gracious to Theresa May, which I thought he would be, as she's the outgoing prime minister, and she was the first world leader to meet him when he was in office. But, you know, it's never guaranteed, but he did. And I thought it was lovely.
Yes.
I mean, I think there's no question that the Trump team will have thought that this visit went very well for them. It was a very strange time for British politics. It's hard to see what we were, from the political side, going to gain from this, given that he was meeting a prime minister who, as you say, leaves office today, effectively. He didn't make any enormous gaffes. There was quite a lot of consternation over his statement that the NHS would be on the table in any Brexit trade deal, which he then flipped on when he was asked about it later in the week and clearly didn't really understand the question, to be honest. I think it's difficult, isn't it? I'm by no means a royalist, but clearly he was impressed, and I think some of that sort of, you called him humble, I think some of that sort of reverence, we saw a more polite Trump in that press conference, clearly came from the fact that he was slightly overwhelmed by the amount of pomp that we sort of poured all over him during the week. People have very mixed feelings about that, in terms of how they feel as British people when we do that kind of thing. But clearly it impressed him. Mm. It spoke to him in a way that, you know, lots of guilt everywhere does speak to President.
Bonnie, the Queen has been hugely praised for her handling of things. What did you make of the way she dealt with it?
Well, thankfully, Trump's visit gave me one of those rare occasions actually to tune out of Trump world. So I didn't see a lot of it on purpose. My father was here. My late father was here as part of the D-Day push. And the fact that the coverage I did see didn't include or barely include any soldiers of color. I'm talking about Muslims as well as African Americans. I think it was a disgrace. And actually was emblematic of the world that Trump has ushered in. It's interesting, again, and I'll go back, my father was a veteran, my uncles were veterans, my brother-in-law is a Vietnam vet, my brother is a vet, my nephew is a vet. We had a draft dodger take the salute as commander-in-chief. To me, that was disgusting. And I think we mustn't normalize what Donald Trump has done to the presidency of the United States. And, you know, we can all try and do that because we need to live in the world. We need to do that. But he has disrupted the office of the president of the United States to a degree that if we get it back together again, it's going to be a miracle.
Sarah? Well, for one, I mean, I respect all soldiers of different races and ethnicities, but at the time in the 1940s England, there just weren't that many veterans of color.
Wrong.
Well,
Sarah,
not like
really,
they are, not
really
to the level
bad
that
thing
they
to
are.
Say.
No, I'm
That's
not.
That's a
being,
bad thing to say.
Listen, there are not many still alive today. I don't think, but I recognize everyone who served. I'm just talking about the demographics that were the United Kingdom at the time.
What about the United States, our country?
Yes, we have great representation there, but there were more. I'm not going to go into that right now. But what I'd say is also that the Trump presidency is, he's one man. The country is still running. We have wonderful people actually running the country. The presidency doesn't have as much power as you think. It is delegated to a cabinet. It is delegated to civil servants. I think that what was wonderful about this visit is it built a lot of goodwill for whoever comes in next as prime minister in between our both countries. And I believe Donald Trump will be elected again. This is not his last visit to the UK. And I think as the UK leaves the EU, this was a wonderful time to really see closer relations between both
when
countries.
When he talked about putting the NHS, he pulled back on
I
it.
I don't think he understood the question.
Well, that's the problem.
That doesn't speak
this
highly
is
to
the
him,
problem,
Sarah.
Well, Sarah. And this is what I'm saying about.
I don't think he heard the question.
This is the problem.
Theresa May had to
Sarah,
repeat.
Sarah, he has an obligation. This is what I'm talking about: normalization. And to say that he doesn't have as much power as I think he has, Donald Trump has taken every ounce of power that the presidency has. We don't even know all the power the presidency has because of Donald Trump. Donald Trump. I'm not going to go into a long Donald Trump thing, okay? Because that's important not to do that. But Donald Trump mentioned our NHS as well as the American ambassador as being on the table. He
so
rolled
when you
it
do a
back.
Trade agreement,
no, hang on,
all
wait
different
then,
things
just,
are on the table.
Wait.
Bonnie, let Sarah answer that point and then let's move on.
Let's move on. Yeah. So with the trade deal, you you put everything on the table and you decide what is worth trading and where your comparative advantage is. There are a lot of American companies that produce pharmaceuticals and medical devices, as do the UK. I think that's what they meant. But in the end, they didn't realize what a polarizing issue that was for people. I can tell you, the United States can't even deal with their own healthcare system. They do not want to manage the British healthcare system.
Jess, it seemed to me that Melania was greatly admired as rather a cool customer. What did you think of the coverage of her?
I find her fascinating, I have to say. She's the ultimate kind of blank slate upon which we all want to project our own sort of hopes and desires for what she's actually thinking, because none of us have any idea. She's so not vocal as a first lady that actually we don't know what she cares about. Lots of people say they feel sorry for her, say she seems to be trapped in an unhappy marriage. There's probably a little bit of them projecting what they wish for her to be thinking on her on that. And I thought there was a really fascinating debate in our office amongst the women about whether it was sexist to be admiring of the clothes that she was wearing, because obviously Trump doesn't receive that kind of coverage. I thought she looked great. I'm not a supporter of her husband's politics in any way. But I do think it's interesting, particularly for a first lady that isn't vocal about the things that she cares about. Her clothes are absolutely a kind of statement about where she is. We get very little from her. And if you remember, there was that sort of iconic image of her when she was visiting that child migrant detention centre in the US at a time when lots of people were saying, you know, how can she as a mother support the separation of families that her husband is carrying out? And she wore that jacket as she got on her private jet that said, "I don't care" on the back. Now, you can't tell me that she's not a woman who thinks about the image that she projects of herself to the world. So I would argue it's a perfectly valid thing to discuss.
Bonnie, how would you compare the coverage of what she wore with similar coverage when it was Michelle Obama who was here and people were asking themselves, is it sexist to care about what she's wearing?
I think with respect to Melania Trump and all first ladies, they've got a hard row to hoe, as we say in America. It's very difficult being a first lady because we project a lot on them. They have various duties that they try to pick up that sort of is in the kind of vein of their husband. Barack Obama was an activist president. He came in with a political agenda. Michelle Obama is a lawyer, Harvard trained. She practiced as a lawyer. Melania Trump was a model. So, you know, and they're both human beings and they're both valid. But probably part of that pressure is because that is what she was. That was her career. Now, we are in a different media age as well. All of us can talk more now. So we can do all sorts of bitty little things about a woman and say this and say that. I don't pay attention to Melania Trump. She's of absolutely no interest to me. But what is fascinating is how people are projecting sort of Jackie Kennedy image on her. I'm old enough to remember Jackie Kennedy, and she ain't no Jackie Kennedy. So I think where we are now is trying to fill the space that Melania, and probably rightfully so, has left us, and that is a space we fill.
Sarah, you raised your eyebrows when Bonnie said she ain't no Jackie Kennedy. Why?
Well, I don't think Bonnie answered the question about the coverage between Michelle Obama and Melania. I mean, you know, Michelle Obama has been on 6 covers of Vogue magazine, at least 3 while she was First Lady, and here we actually have a model as First Lady who is statuesque and beautiful, and she carries herself with class, which is very similar to Jackie O. Yet the fashion world has banished her because of her husband's politics. And you can, to me, that's...
What do you mean the fashion world has banished her?
Well, there are designers that refuse to work with her. Philip Tracy designed that beautiful hat she wore yesterday, or was it 2 days ago, in Portsmouth, and he has gotten absolutely hellfire by the fashion world on his Instagram account for having designed for the First Lady who happens to be married to President Trump. And you can ask if that's, you know, if she should be held account for her husband's beliefs. She's her own person. But, you know, everyone was glowing about Michelle Obama when she was over here. There's clearly a media bias towards her. And maybe it's because it's towards her husband's politics. But I think Melania Trump is someone who has never wanted wanted to be First Lady, and she has taken on the role in a very stoic way. She does care about her fashion. She wore a London print Gucci dress as she boarded Air Force One. She wore a Burberry blouse when she landed here. And she also wore a Claire White color, if I have the name right, of Givenchy, who designed Meghan Markle's dress, designed her red dress.
Yes.
I just don't agree that the coverage of Melania versus Michelle Obama is to do with her husband's politics. Michelle Obama is somebody who is a campaigner, who has been vocal on women's rights across the globe, who had an agenda around child obesity and health in the US, and has continued to campaign on women's rights since her husband left office. I just don't think they're comparable in terms of the amount of coverage that they deserve.
Well, the designers have actually said, because of her husband's policies, I will not dress her.
That's
I mean, they
right,
have come
though.
Out and said
that's
that.
That's their right.
Let's go on to Theresa May, who had a difficult, I suspect, last week as leader. How well did she handle that difficult week, Jess?
I mean, for a woman whose tenure has been beset largely of her own making, but by very difficult moments, she had a terrible last week to contend with. Trump here and then Peterborough, the by-election overnight. So she's coming into her final day in office with this loss for the Tories. I mean, she dealt with it as well as she could, let's be honest. That press conference was fascinating for me, just to see how quickly power drains. Nobody was particularly interested in what she had to say. And there was that moment when Trump couldn't hear the NHS question, and she, which was obviously a very contentious question for everybody in the UK watching, and she sort of had to lean over and pass it on to him. And I don't know, there was no sense that was two world leaders of equal stature in that press conference.
But what about, Sarah, the way she handled the D-Day, when, you know, she was there with Macron, she was making speeches. Was she a stateswoman?
I think she was, definitely. And I think, if anything, that there was probably the highlight and honour of her week was to honour these men who, this is the last time we'll get to actually in person honour them, most likely. They're in their 90s now. I think it was very good, and it was good for other world leaders, I think, to kind of, like Macron did, show a bond, show appreciation and respect to her.
Bonnie?
I hold no brief for Theresa May. She's what the French call a fonctionnaire. She just does her job. There isn't anything else about her, but I have to say, I was angry at the coverage of her speech, because almost every paper had her picture, the picture of her at the end when she cried. Mm. And I thought that's what they'd think of us in the end.
Women's World Cup begins in Paris today, France versus South Korea. Will you be watching? Sarah?
I'm really sorry. I'm not a football fan.
But you know, America is so good at women's
football. I know.
Football.
I got to tell you, growing up in America, I was very intimidated by my fellow girl soccer players. That's what we call them. And I hated running up and down a field. So I stayed to the court sports like tennis and basketball.
Bonnie.
I agree with Sarah. I mean, soccer is a girl's game in America. I mean, I played it when I was a girl a long time ago. I was a guard. We were just sort of shocked to see guys running around in shorts and long socks. So it's finally gotten, it's over there now and it's doing very well. But I'm a rugby person, so. But good luck to the women's.
Yeah. But you watch women's rugby as well as men's, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Rugby.
Jess.
I mean, I have to say, to my shame, I've never watched a game of women's football.
That is shameful, frankly.
It is, I know.
Never and to have done it.
I know, and I think I will. I think I will watch this one. It's on the BBC, apparently. It's going to be on BBC One, a couple of games on BBC Two. I think I'm going to get into it. We'll be covering it on HuffPost, actually. Not sort of match reports, but we're definitely going to be covering what it means for particularly young girls watching it in this country.
And don't forget that England will play Scotland on Sunday.
And they're a great team.
They're
England
ranked
women
third.
Are a great team, and we need to stress that they are they're world beaters. They're a great team.
Scotland are good as well.
Well, they are good.
We have to say that.
They are good.
I don't know where they're ranked.
Can't show favouritism
exactly
at this
good.
Stage of
they're
the game. So, Bonnie Greer, Sarah Elliott, and Jess Brammer, thank you all very much indeed for being with us this morning.
Thank
now,
you.
Still to come in today's programme, Elizabeth McGovern playing a wife in the play The Starry Messenger, a chaperone in a film of the same name, and becoming Lady Cora again in the cinema version of Downton Abbey, and the final episode of the serial, I Am a Slave. Now, on Monday, Jane's going to be discussing women returning to work after a break. If you've tried to return after a long time, raising children or caring for elderly parents or indeed both, how easy was it to find a job? We'd like to hear your experiences, whether they were good or bad. You can get in touch with us through the website or, of course, on Twitter. That's at BBC Woman's Hour. Now, across the week, dubbed Coaching Week, we've been talking to women who coach others in perfecting their sport. We've discussed rugby, netball, wheelchair basketball, football, of course, and today it's tennis. Francesca Lewis fell in love with the game when she was only 8, and she went on to compete in tournaments across the world. But it was as a tennis coach rather than a player that she found her calling. She now trains some of the best junior players in the world at Swansea's Regional Player Development Centre.
There we go, it's better. I've pretty much been here since I was 8 years old because I started as a player here and then transitioned through university. Played until I was 21 and then moved into coaching because that was what I'd always wanted to do. So I haven't really left yet. To have a job where I'm able to be on a tennis court all day is such a luxury. But also working with kids, I just love working with little ones because they love the game as well. So you're constantly with people that are passionate about what they're doing. The most important thing is to build that relationship with these kids where they feel like they can trust you from a young age and they know that you're there to support them. That's so much more important sometimes than having the most knowledge and just being able to fully commit to them again. I think that's one of the most important qualities that you can have as a coach. You have to live it and breathe it, and it really can be 24 hours sometimes. So this is our little S&C part of the tennis centre now. So this is their strength and conditioning. So they're all pretty high level players. So if they're not doing this type of stuff, then high risk of injury. But you're just not going to maximise performance as well, because if they're getting stronger, they can hit the ball faster, they can get into the corners quicker. So I think this is why our guys sometimes have a bit of a one-up on some others, because we do really do it properly. A lot of people aren't buying into this yet, but these girls... So Erin is 12 now. She's probably been doing this since she was maybe 7, the gym work. So really important for them.
Hi, I'm Erin and my coach is Fran Lewis. I started when I was 3 and I've loved it all my life. And Francesca's brought me through everything. She's very fun and she works you really hard. I like all the work she's doing with me. Yeah, she's really good.
I normally like to start them about 5-6 years old. Then the first thing is just making them love the game, so I don't even start with anything technical, tactical. It's about fun and hopefully getting them hooked on that. And then if you can see that they're physically good, then you're trying to put a lot more shape into their games. But I don't push for that until I feel like they've got that real love for the game. But it's just as they mature, teaching them the technical side a lot more and then the tactical side, obviously mental comes into it. And I spend a lot of time at tournaments with these little ones as well, so most of what I do is tournament work. So we will travel together and we're just trying to get them in good habits for the future, so getting used to having a good pre-match routine, analysing after the match and trying to take the positives, because it's a tough sport out there. It can get pretty lonely and it's very easy to be negative after a bad performance. I try and help them through that side as much as I can. These children are playing at a very high level and they're mentally not ready a lot of the time to deal with that. So I think, again, that's one of the coach's biggest jobs, to help them understand those ups and downs. Because I remember myself from playing, I was a very private person. I actually wouldn't speak to my coaches a lot. And you're really putting yourself through some mental torture, actually. I remember sometimes I would lose and I wouldn't want to eat for the week, even that extreme. Or I definitely wouldn't be talking to someone for 2 or 3 days. So I think you need someone that you feel really close to, where you can almost get rid of that within 10, 20 minutes after a match. We have huge roles as coaches to do that, and to be fair on them. Like, I will only ever pull a player up if their attitude or effort isn't right. I'm so accepting of if the performance is not great, because that's sport. As long as they're giving everything that they can, then I try and help them to realise that's enough, and we can always go back on next day, we work on the game again, that's fine. But I'm hoping that I do have a set of players who are a bit more relaxed than normal and can cope with higher pressure situations, because they know after the match, okay, it's not the end of the world. They can get a bit upset, but then we reset within half an hour and we don't hold on to it. So I hope that I'm already starting to get them into that sort of routine. So we're on the outdoor courts. On here you've got Layla Savage. She's a very good player, so she did very well nationally at 9-under, 10-under. She was one of the best players in Britain. She's been a bit unlucky at the moment. She's had a spell sort of a year and a half with some tough injuries. So she's just starting to come back now, and she's making some really good progress. So that's Layla. And then we're moving on here to Mimi. So Mimi is 11 years old. She's been at the centre with me since she was 6. She was not great when she came in, but the progress that she made within just a few weeks was pretty exceptional. And now Mimi is number 2 in Britain.
Hi, my name is Mimi Shi. I'm from Swansea and Francesca coaches me. Francesca is important, so because it helps me develop, and then she'll help me to play my game and make changes if I need to. She's a great coach.
Hello, I'm Layla Savage and I'm a tennis player. I've been in France since I was very young, since I've started playing here, and we've really bonded. She gives like amazing pointers when you need it. She's lovely to talk to off court too, and she really helps when you need to.
I've got a couple of players here at Swansea now who I started with at 5 years old, who have gone on to win big international titles, like multiple national titles, which, you know, people don't do round here very often. It's not very common in Wales that we have these type of players. So to have two or three players at Swansea who are not just the best in Britain, but the best in Europe, some of them the best in the world, I'm really proud of, because I've had them the whole way through. But I would say I'm more proud of them than I am myself. But then probably the other thing is just making tennis a lot more accessible around here. So I spend most of my time fundraising and finding ways to get sponsorship in for these kids, because when I started off, what I realised is some of the most talented players coming into the programme actually couldn't really afford to train. So for me, I just thought, that's such a waste. We're losing our best players here. So from a young age, I started trying to tackle that and think, right, I'm not going to make any excuses here. We're going to find a way. If they want to train this much, they're going to train this much. If they want to play these tournaments, they're going to be able to do it, regardless of if they have money or not. And I think we're in a really good place with that in Swansea at the moment. We run a really good sponsorship fund, and we're really supporting the players as heavily as we can. We're actually, I think, one of only 3 centres in the UK to been awarded a regional and a local centre. So local is to look after the best really little ones, like 9 and under, and regional is 14 and under. So I always wanted to get this place in Swansea to a point where we are one of the strongest centres, well, the strongest centre in Wales. And I've just always wanted to be producing players that are putting Wales on the map. Yes, there we go, ace.
Francesca Lewis. A new play opened in the West End last month, surrounded by some excitement. The Starry Messenger was written by Kenneth Lonergan, best known for Manchester by the Sea, which won the Oscar for Original Screenplay in 2017. The play was to star Matthew Broderick as a middle-aged astronomer disappointed at his lack of success in his career. His wife, struggling with a teenage son, elderly relatives and an inattentive husband, is played by Elizabeth McGovern, who has a new film, The Chaperone, and Downton Abbey, the movie, in which she is again Lady Cora, which will be released in September. Elizabeth, what drew you to The Starry Messenger as the frustrated wife of a man in the throes of a midlife crisis?
That's a very easy question to answer. It was Kenny's writing. He is one of those writers that is a gift to any actor. He has a evocative, unusual a way of suggesting character that is complex and has dimension. And I think there are very few actors that wouldn't just leap at the opportunity to be in his world and speak his lines.
Now, one of the themes of the play is the closure of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, which was actually demolished in 1997, which obviously meant a lot to Lonergan and to Matthew Broderick, who plays your husband. How aware of its importance were you before you came to the play?
Zero. Even though I lived not far from the Hayden Planetarium. But the charming part of that story is that Kenny and Matthew, I believe, met age 15 in the class of this man who was teaching extracurricular astronomy. And they were two, I have to assume, fairly nerdy kids that wanted to take this extracurricular class. And so it was a place that had a lot of resonance for them. There is a planetarium that has replaced the Hayden Planetarium, and I don't know what that's like. But I think people were very fond of the Hayden Planetarium because of its kind of old-fashioned, warm, clunky charm. And for Kenny, it's a wonderful way of putting this story, which is about human beings negotiating their lives and relationships, but it's in the context of the larger picture, which is that we're on this planet hurtling through the cosmos, because this man's imagination always refers back to the stars, the bigger picture. And it's a wonderful sort of overview to the minutiae, the detail of all the characters as they interact that you're seeing on stage.
Because at the same time, he comes home to you and you are saying, well, are we going to go to your mother-in-law? My mother-in-law.
Exactly. He's married, you know, and that's what marriage becomes, and that's what love becomes. And so, like most of us, he has to reconcile how to keep that love alive. What is love when you're talking about laundry and mothers-in-law? So this is the kind of thing that we all sort of process at a certain point in the middle part of our life. And I think that it's this process that Kenny is interested in, and what this process leads to in terms of him bouncing off all sorts of different characters at different points in their life in the story.
Now, you grew up in Los Angeles, although I know you trained in New York. What drew you to acting?
I can hardly remember. It almost feels as though it was something. Well, thank you for saying that. But in my case, it almost feels like something I was doing before I even thought about it, if that makes any sense. I probably had a higher trajectory in terms of a kind of what I would deem to be a more important profession in my mind. But it was something that I was always doing, and then suddenly was earning money. I mean, it sounds a little bit facile to say that, but it is true. It kind of found me, and it's a place of comfort and joy for me. So
it found you rather well. I mean, your first major film role was in Ordinary People, directed by Robert Redford.
Yes, indeed. I know. I do sometimes wonder. I mean, the prosaic version of the story is that I was just seen by an agent in a school play. I remember it was Skin of Our Teeth, a Thornton Wilder play. And she left a note at the office of the administrator at school and said, come in and see me. And I was applying for colleges. And I thought, well, I'll get some summer jobs and I'll earn some money. And I went in to see her. And they were seeing a lot of kids for Ordinary People at the time. And I just went on a big cattle call, they call them, a casting call. And four meetings later, I was there in Redford's office. So I didn't even realize that it was amazing. I thought, like, this happened all the time to everybody because I had no experience to compare it to.
What brought you to London and marriage to Simon Curtis, who began, I think, as an assistant director at the Royal Court?
He did. Yeah, very good. That was another thing, I think. I think a lot of my life, I would say, is me just riding a wave without having a worked out plan. And this Simon Curtis came into my life through a mutual friend, and I didn't particularly notice one way or another until I met him in a much more deep way 10 years later, and we got to know each other very well, and he's been my partner, it's been one of the most wonderful, fortuitous things that's ever happened to me. And it did bring me to England, which was never part of my plan either. But I've absolutely loved it and feel very grateful.
Now, I know you're responsible for a film, The Chaperone, which we haven't seen here yet, but no doubt will. And it's about the chaperone of the film star Louise Brooks. Why were you so keen on that story, that you bought the story and you produced the film as well as the period?
I did. It's based on a book. And I felt as though the story was an opportunity to say so many things. It takes place in the 1920s, which was a time of great change for women. And one of the forefronts, the poster girl for that change, was this Louise Brooks, who was one of the first flappers. And she personified the liberated woman. And it is her journey with this middle-aged woman who I play, and the effect that she has on this middle-aged woman, that I felt was such an interesting way of seeing a woman who is late in age, making discoveries and coming to terms with her ownership of her own happiness and her own sexuality through her interaction with this girl who affects her very deeply. And I thought it was a very interesting way of telling a story that is quite a universal one about how women have a right to control their own fate and own their own sexuality, and a right to have a sexuality. And it's also kind of fun and entertaining story about an odd couple.
And so to Lady Cora and Downton Abbey and the film, which is coming out later this year. How surprised were you at the amazing success of the television series?
Yes, completely. I continue to be totally gobsmacked by it. I really am. But of course I enjoy it.
How much of a family do you become? I mean, there have been six series so far. When you're in a cast that works together for such a long time, will you miss them when it stops?
Yes, I don't think that there's anything quite like it, because we do grow up together. I mean, we go through something together that is quite a traumatic experience in some ways, which is to be catapulted into this strange position where people are responding to you as a character. And so, I mean, that can be a very bonding experience, or a lot of the times people who do long-term series end up falling out because it is a traumatic thing to process. And in our case, it has really bonded this really nice, incredibly talented group of people. So I feel really lucky.
You're 57 now. You filmed War of the Worlds for television, the play, the other film, Downton Abbey. Is it getting easier for women to get good work in film and theatre as they get older now?
Well, I do feel very lucky myself. I mean, there's a lot of paddling that goes on underneath the surface of the water. I feel like it does take a toll. I work very, very hard. I think it's easier to find parts in the theatre than it is in television and film. I think that is still a challenge for us.
I was talking to Elizabeth McGovern, Lots of you contributed to the discussion of our review of the week's news. Mandy said, listening to the discussion on representation on the D-Day celebrations, my dad is 83 and regularly saw men of colour from all around the world in the UK preparing for the push. To say that not many people of colour were over here then is misleading and disingenuous, to say the least. In addition to the US soldiers, many, many men of colour were involved from across the Commonwealth. One of my dad's stories from the time when evacuated involved a wonderful tank driver who comforted my dad when his dog got run over. He still talks about it. Judith Grant said, the idea that people of colour were not part of D-Day or the war is a great disservice to the men and women of the Commonwealth who served and sacrificed their lives. My father, from St Vincent, served and lost many of his friends. Jackie Schneider said, isn't the concept of the First Lady utterly redundant in a democracy? I think it's demeaning. And Christine said, I really think that what presidents' wives wear is their own business. In fact, what anyone wears is really their own choice and should not be up for discussion. Surely Women's Hour ought to be more interesting. Well, join me for a very interesting weekend Women's Hour. We'll be looking ahead to the Women's Football World Cup in France. The author, Elif Shafak, talks about her latest novel, 10 Minutes, 38 Seconds in This Strange World. And the writer and journalist Francesca Siegel tells us about her identical twin daughters born prematurely at 30 weeks and how her expectations of becoming a mother were shattered by their early arrival. That's Weekend Women's Hour tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Do join me if you can. Bye-bye.
I'm Simon Mundy, host of Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions, covering topics like resilience, tribalism, and fear with people like this.
We keep talking about fear, and to me, I always want to bring it back to, are you actually in danger?
That's Alex Honnold, star of the Oscar-winning film Free Solo, in which he climbed a 3,000-foot sheer cliff without ropes.
And so, I mean, a lot of those, you know, social anxieties things, and certainly I've had a lot of issues with talking to attractive people in my life. I'm like, oh no, like I could never do that. And it certainly feels like you're going to die, but Realistically, you're not going to die. And that's all practice too.
Have a listen to Don't Tell Me the Score, full of useful everyday tips from incredible people on BBC Sounds.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.